Every year we do the bracket wager, the sheet of integrity wager, where Golic and I go head-to-head, making selections on the NCAA tournament. This year, again, I won. Loser has to do something humiliating. And in all the years we've been doing this, and I think this was the eighth year that we've done it, this was my favorite. Golic lost, and thus on Saturday on campus at a book signing at the campus bookstore and all over the place at Notre Dame, he had to wear Anthony Munoz's game-worn USC jersey all over campus. The whole sheet of integrity wager is brought to you by Werner Ladder, the official ladder of the NCAA basketball championships and the official ladder of professional contractors who rise above the rest. And as I requested, we are inundated this morning with pictures, camera phone pictures, video, and a fabulous video package is right now on the brand new Mike and Micah page at ESPNRadio.com. Go over there right now, or at any point you get a chance today, check out on the Mike and Mike page at ESPNRadio.com a full video presentation of Golic in the jersey. How was it?
Well, first, I'd like to thank everybody at the bookstore who showed up and wanted their book signed, Mike and Mike's Rules for Sports and Life. It was really nice everybody to show up for that. It really was. All in their Notre Dame gear.
I had a lot of people giving me updates. Yeah. It was packed.
Yeah, it was. It was a lot of people there, as I mentioned, in their Notre Dame gear. In the Notre Dame bookstore,
yes.
As I'm sitting there with a stinking number 77 jersey on, and I'll get to why I wish I didn't wear an Anthony Munoz jersey in a moment.
Yeah,
but it was hard. It was very difficult. I was up in a room before I came down for the signing, and a gentleman comes in and says, "You know, you may want to start early. There's a big line out there. It's going to be really crowded." I'm like, "Oh God, I wasn't mentally prepared."
Yeah.
I thought I had about 20 more minutes to kind of really ease into it, so I had to get down there. And I mean, let me just say this. You know, we've walked into a few book signings and people kind of clap for us.
Sure.
There was a smattering of boos.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There was a smattering of boos. There were many people that didn't think I would do it. And many that said, you know what? I give you credit for doing it. You're a man of your word in saying you'd wear it because this is a heck of a place to wear it. It was difficult to do. No doubt about it. There were some people that were, you know, that we thought, hey, it's cool, it's nice, you did it. There were people, I took a lot of pictures, and you mentioned Werner Ladder, how you know, they've been so great. They actually set up their ladders in a way where you had a lot of great seating around there to do these pictures. I had more than a few people, Greeny, that said, I just want the autograph on the book. I'm not taking a picture of you next to that jersey. I won't do it. You know, so people just would not get in a picture with me in that jersey. So you got the response you wanted, let me tell you that. And then,
how about the rest of the day?
Well, afterward, I left there, and, you know, there was still a couple hours before the game, so I had the jersey on. You know, we all went over to the stadium, had the jersey on. People are stopping me, taking pictures. And, you know, so I went in, I put my Notre Dame football sweatshirt over. Thank God, I felt so much cleaner,
yeah.
You know, when I put that on. And then after the game, when I walked out, I you know, took it back off and went back home, you know, with it on.
Yeah, for those who are wondering, that was part of the agreement.
Right, right.
I agreed to this, that it would not be right to have him in the game. It was the blue-gold game, the spring game. And to have Mike in there and that jersey would have taken some attention away from the, how much, I don't know, but any attention it took away from the players would have been inappropriate.
The jersey was long, so it was sticking out underneath my Notre Dame sweatshirt. I even went up and talked to the AD, Jack Swarbrick, at halftime. And I was talking to him, he looked at me, and he saw the maroon coming out, and he said, "You got the jersey on, don't you?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "But it's covered. I didn't have to wear it in the game." He's like, "Oh, that's good."
Yeah.
But the reason for Moon, because I wanted this thing marked up.
Yeah.
This was one time I didn't mind if people wanted to throw a few eggs at me. But it's amazing. People love Anthony Munoz.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do it because it was Moon's jersey. Had I had on a Sanchez jersey or a Reggie Bush jersey or somebody else, I think it would have been defaced. But because it was Moon, they're like, you know, Moon's such a great guy. They didn't want to do it to his jersey. So his jersey walked out of there pretty clean. I almost was throwing stuff at myself.
We will have Anthony Munoz a little after 8 o'clock Eastern time this morning, a little after 7 o'clock Central time to give his thoughts. But the deed has been done.
Yeah.
The payment has been made.
Yeah.
Golic is a lot of things, but he's not a welcher. He did indeed wear the jersey on campus at Notre Dame. And again, there is a full video presentation on the brand new Mike and Mike page at ESPNRadio.com. And by the way, our book tour does continue. Quickly, this week, we will be in West Hartford, Connecticut Tuesday. We will be out in New Jersey on Wednesday. We will have all the details are up at ESPNRadio.com for where you can find us if you would like to.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
with the Professor John Clayton, who takes us inside the huddle here on Mike and Mike in the Morning. John, when you see what wound up happening with the two quarterbacks we couldn't talk about on Friday, Clawson ultimately falling second round to Carolina, McCoy falling third round to Cleveland, how do you feel about the situations those guys wound up in and their chances to start getting on the field soon in the NFL?
Well, even though it was tough financially, because Clawson lost probably $44 to $50 million in the drop, but I think he ended up with a perfect situation because now he goes to a running team, which I think is going to give him a chance to get on the field quickly. All he has to do is try to beat out Matt Moore, and if he is as quarterback ready as everybody thought, he can start to prove some of those critics wrong by going on the field. So I think in a lot of ways, even though it was painful for him, it was a good situation. And I think in Colt McCoy's case, it probably was what it exactly what the scouting report said. You know, he's not big, he doesn't have the strongest arm, and he had a third round grade. But the good news for him is it goes for an organization that's going to know what to do with a quarterback. Mike Holmgren targeted him, liked him more than Jimmy Clawson, was patient enough to wait to try to see if he can get him in the right position, and now is going to take him with Eric Mangini's staff and try to at least let him just sit, enjoy, learn the offense, and then see how he emerges in 2011. So even though they dropped as far as the money, even though they dropped as far as the ratings, I thought both quarterbacks ended up in good situations.
Another quarterback who changed teams, Jason Campbell, goes from Washington to the Raiders, which really signifies a couple of things, that Al Davis is admitting the mistake of Jamarcus Russell. I think that's a step in the right direction. And now Jason Campbell gets a chance on another team. Does he go into this as a starter, or is it going to be an open competition with Gretkowski?
It'll be an open competition, but he's going to win the competition, and I think that the Raiders are already showing that he's going to win the competition because they gave him a second year to the contract just to show the commitment that they want to make. They don't want this a one-year situation, so at least now he's going to be under contract for 2 years, and that means that Marcus Russell probably will be released. I don't see anybody picking him up in a trade. They'll probably do it this week because the problem that they have with a minicamp coming up, if they put him on the field and he gets hurt, then they're liable for $9 million, and they've already lost too much money, too many games, all those different things in this game. So I think Jason Campbell ended up in a perfect situation. He'll go there. He'll have a chance to start. They're going to try to build that offense around him. And so it's kind of a nice, smooth transition. And for the Raiders, it came at a bargain price. I know it could be worth a fourth-round pick, but for that fourth-round pick to work, I think Al would pay it because that means that they would have to make the playoffs, and Jason Campbell would have to be a Pro Bowler. So fourth rounder, I think he'd give up for a quarterback now that can finally knock off Jamarcus Russell.
Right now, the Raiders, five quarterbacks on their roster. Jamarcus Russell, Jason Campbell, Bruce Gretkowski, Charlie Fry, and Kyle Bowler.
You would have to. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, but of course, Gretkowski, at the moment can't do anything because he's coming off the injury with the bicep muscle, so he's out, kind of sidelined for about 4 weeks.
And it's just amazing, as you're saying, you think that they will release Russell this week. They won't be able to trade him. What will happen to him? Will someone pick him up?
You wonder. I mean, at some stage, somebody's going to pick him up. He's too young. He's got enough talent. And now he falls into that category that's hit so many first-round quarterbacks, the Joey Harringtons, the David Carrs, that almost have to go somewhere as a third quarterback and just try to resurrect their career. But, he let himself go. I mean, he was not in shape enough. He has the great arm, but he never really developed a lot of the skills. I mean, here it is this long into his pro career, and he can't stare off a cornerback. He just stares at the corner. The cornerback responds and has about as much chance to catch the ball as, say, the wide receiver does.
What a mess. John Clayton with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. All right, to the draft, which John was one of the hosts of the ESPN radio coverage Thursday and Friday. Who were the big winners in your view? Which teams in the NFL had the best weekends?
I think Seattle had the best because they could have come up with as many as five starters. They get a new backfield with the just almost giveaway trades for Lendell White. They were able to get Leon Washington. I think that you can look at the fact that they've got Earl Thomas now at the safety position. They finally were able to go ahead and get a left tackle and then get Golden Tate. I think Carolina certainly won very much because, sit in the second round and get a quarterback, and then on top of it to get Tony Pike in the sixth round, and then to be able to get some wide receivers. They've got some speed. They've got a younger team right now. I think they came out a bit. On the flip side, I was kind of confused by Minnesota because Minnesota, you know, they were looking obviously for a running back to replace Chester Taylor, but they made the move in the first round to give Jared Best to division rival in Detroit, and then had to trade up to get Toby Gerhardt. That to me was a little bit puzzling, and I hate to say it, Greeny, you know, as good as the Jets have been this off season, then they have been very good, one of the most aggressive teams and one of the better teams. I don't know if they took a step forward. They're going to go with Vladimir Dukas as a starting left guard, but they let Alan Faneca go, and I don't know if their backfield is better with LaDainian Tomlinson, Sean Green, and Joe McKnight, as opposed to what they had with Thomas Jones, Leon Washington, and Sean Green.
I don't disagree. I think two of the moves can be viewed as financially motivated. Now, Thomas Jones, there was a signing bonus. They didn't want to pay him, and they let him go. They tried to bring him back, but his feelings were hurt. And then here with Alan Faneca, you know, I read all these stories that said he graded out as their lowest rated offensive lineman last year, and he was due a whole bunch of money. But boy, the offensive line was so good.
Yeah, they were.
Such an enormous strength of your team. Take a risk now to throw a rookie in the middle of that. So I agree with you on both counts. And the Jets have had a great offseason, but they did make a few decisions, John, that were, I don't know, puzzling is the right word, but certainly leads you to some questions.
Well, and the one thing I wonder about it, too, I look at it from the leadership standpoint. Thomas Jones was a leader in that locker room, and Alan Faneca made things better for DeBrickashaw Ferguson. I don't think it's any accident that Ferguson had his best two seasons with Faneca on his side. You know, maybe his play may not have been as good at the end of the season, but I still think that, you know, he made everything right on that offensive line. And to lose that leadership, I think, is going to be a little bit of a problem.
So how about other players now? We said some players that didn't go as free agents would have to wait after the draft. You still have the Albert Haynesworth situation. Is he still on the trading block? What other notable players out there may still be on the move?
Well, Jacksonville is releasing John Henderson today because they took four defensive linemen in the draft, totally redoing their D-line. So Henderson's going to be out. Now the Darren Sharper situation will start to heat up. You know, there was no safety taken that's going to really replace him in New Orleans, but there's some rumblings that teams like Washington and some others may look at Darren Sharper. He's going to at least be in play. Terrell Owens, there's no spot for him right now. And I don't know, the one team I thought that would do something, Oakland, they were able to get another young, fast receiver. So I still wonder where Tio's going to land. His name's going to be in the use. For Faneca, I think there may be some interest in Chicago. Again, getting that veteran leadership in there. He'll obviously come at a bargain price because the Jets, when they let him go, have a $5.25 million guarantee. So Faneca's not playing for the money. He's playing for the opportunity.
John Clayton takes us inside the huddle regularly, and a terrific job over the course of the last week and change, looking back and now upon the NFL draft. Thank you, Professor. We'll check in the next few days.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
McShay joins us in studio. Give me the two or three teams you thought, top to bottom, had the best weekends.
I thought Seattle. The Seattle Seahawks did. I know it's probably not a surprise. It's easier to have the best draft when you have two picks in the first round, but you got to take advantage of good fortune, and they did that. And you also have to be in position to make a play on a player when he falls to you. And I thought they did that twice in the first round. Russell Okung at 6, they thought was going to go at number 4, the offensive tackle from Oklahoma State. And then Earl Thomas falls to them at 14. I thought one of the underrated, you know, pressure points or turning points of this year's draft was when Philadelphia moves up to 13 and takes Brandon Graham, the defensive end. Great player, liked the pick, but most people thought it was going to be Earl Thomas they'd trade up for. That allows Earl Thomas to fall to Seattle at 14.
Yeah.
And then after that, we see a defensive line run. I think Brandon Graham kind of sparked that whole run. But I thought Seattle had a great draft. I thought the Baltimore Ravens had a great draft. They move out of the
patient draft.
And took advantage of a Denver team moving up, paid a little bit much for Tim Tebow at that 25 spot, get some extra picks, and they killed it top to bottom. They found players from Terrence Cody to the tight ends, Ed Dixon.
Couple tight ends, yeah.
And Dennis Pitta, two guys that I think can contribute early and can be long-time contributors for that organization.
Two teams with a couple tight ends. They did it, and New England did it
as well.
Yeah, right. That's right, Philadelphia. So how about on the other side of it? How about teams that you thought really didn't come out too well?
You know, I was just – the reason I'm walking in here a minute late is I was just debating my good friend Mr. Kuiper on Jacksonville Jaguars. Listen, they reached for Tyson Alualu at 10.
Right.
There's no question about it. But
started it off bad for some people.
Right, and it turned everything around. But – they had, this is an organization that had a great draft last year. And you look at some of their picks, from Cox at cornerback to Knightley at defensive tackle. They get two offensive tackles a year ago. So I think, you know, I just caution from everyone jumping on them right now. Tyson Alualu could turn into a top 10 defensive lineman in the NFL and be a perennial Pro Bowl player. And I think we'll all look at it and say, well, maybe they knew what they were doing. And there were some other teams that were considering him in the first half of the first round. But clearly, you know, the consensus is he was a reach at number 10. And I thought they reached DeAnthony Smith, good player, defensive tackle, but reached there and didn't address any free safety, quarterback. They didn't get any players that I thought they could develop into starters at those positions.
And interesting note on that, their first two picks, you just mentioned, both defensive tackles.
Right.
And it looks like today that Jacksonville is going to release John Henderson, their defensive tackle there. So these young guys are certainly going to get a chance to get in there right away and play.
Mike and Mike McShay is in our studio with us here breaking down what we saw over the weekend. I thought it was interesting that Ralph Wilson, there had been a feeling that Buffalo wanted Tim Tebow.
Right.
Ralph Wilson, the owner of the Bills, said they were never going to maneuver to get Tebow and used the word, quote-unquote, panicked to describe Denver trading up and grabbing him there. The more I've thought about it, the more I think, really, in some ways, Josh McDaniels has pretty much tied his entire wagon now to Tim Tebow. You have to develop him and make him into a quarterback. Otherwise, with the way everyone has looked at the situation, that's ultimately going to be your legacy. If this guy can't play, that's what it's going to look like your legacy is, unless they manage to win a Super Bowl with the pieces around him.
Here's the thing. It doesn't matter what I think about Tim Tebow or what Mel Kiper Jr. thinks about Tim Tebow, what you guys or anyone else in the world. It matters that Josh McDaniels thinks he can develop him into a good starting quarterback in the NFL, because you're dead right, Greeny. When you draft a player at 25 at the quarterback position, you're saying maybe he's not the elite of the elite, so maybe he's not going to be ready right away, but within the next 2 years, he's got to be our starting quarterback. In the next 3-4 years, he's got to be in position to lead us to a Super Bowl. And that's what that's the mindset you have to have to make that decision. If there's a coach in the NFL to do it, it's McDaniels. I mean, he's done Matt Castle, one of the great, you know, behind-the-scenes project developing him from a guy who hadn't played since high school,
right,
with the Patriots to someone who could step in when Tom Brady got injured and then goes on to Kansas City. And, you know, throughout his career, he's done a very good job with quarterbacks. But this is the move. This is the one move that he is absolutely going to tie his career to. It could either make him a Hall of Fame coach, or it could get him fired in the next 3-4 years.
You know, both you guys, I was thinking as McShay was talking, you know, they had the interesting weekend. San Diego, I heard a lot of people questioning how far up they went to get the running back at 12. And we see some of the players that they've lost. Kansas City, I actually liked a lot what they did, but there's still question about the quarterback. And then everywhere I look, I hear people tell me they thought the Raiders had a great weekend. They thought they had a really good draft.
They drafted football players.
And they got to give Jason Campbell a chance now. Yeah. They actually made a decision on a quarterback that makes sense to everybody. Give him a fourth-round pick to get that guy. Yep. The Raiders actually, I think, had a very good weekend, didn't they?
Oh, I think they had an excellent weekend. A lot of people weren't sure about Rolando McClain and taking him at that spot, thought it might be a little high. But I questioned the last two drafts. Not the position that they drafted, but the players they drafted. I don't question this player. You know, this player maybe doesn't have the elite speed that Al Davis always looks for, but man, he could play the linebacker position. And you're right, they made a decision on quarterback. They said, you know, Jamarcus Russell, it's basically done.
Right.
Jason Campbell, you go do your thing. I was happy to see what they did.
And the rest of their draft, McShay, everyone seems to like.
Yeah, you look at what they were able to do going out, and I think they got back to some of the mistakes they made, you know, third round, fourth round. Bruce Campbell is a nice height, weight, speed guy. But we thought they were going to take him at 8. And so the fact that their first couple of picks were solid football players, you know, I think you have to be excited. Lamar Houston, the defensive tackle from Texas, I thought he was a late first round. I mean, I really think he's a good football player. And, you know, the veterans on that team have to be excited, too, because now all of a sudden there's not the whole Jamarcus Russell thing hanging over, you know, a cloud hanging over their head. Another team that has struggled for years and years now as an organization that did well, the Detroit Lions. I think their whole offseason reminds me a lot of what, I'm not saying they're going to be the next Patriots, but it reminds me a lot of what the approach the Patriots took, you know, in like 99, 2000, early in the Bill Belichick regime there. veterans, guys that, you know, teams were getting rid of and moving on from, but could come in, knew the system, are ready to play, and they drafted very well, I thought, throughout this entire draft.
When you talk about off seasons, not just a draft, I think Detroit is going to be one of those teams that you talk about very highly and saying they had a great off season.
What are your questions for McShay? You can stick around for a little bit, right? We're going to keep McShay here. Okay. We're taking your draft questions for Todd McShay. You can text them to us at 73776. That's 7ESPN. Message and data rates apply. Tweet them at twitter.com/Greeny and Golic, and we'll open up the phone lines right now as well. No mocking. We're not going to mock McShay today. We will just take questions at 888. You know what? You've been through enough. 888-SAY-ESPN. That's 888-729-3776. Your questions about your draft for Todd McShay next. Todd McShay, who's in our studio. We just took a look at the draft with our questions. Now it's time for your questions for Todd McShay. 888-SAY-ESPN. Live questions for our draft expert extraordinaire. Bill, you're first up. You're on Mike and Mike in the Morning. What's your question for McShay? Bill.
I got off to a great start.
Yeah, I think we're off and flying here.
Really
Let's
good.
Try Jeremy. Jeremy, you're on Mike and Mike. What's your question for Todd McShay?
Yes, how you doing? My question is, if Josh McDaniel was so panicked to get Tim Tebow, why would he trade for another project like Brady Quinn?
Does the Quinn thing, in retrospect, make less sense now that they got Tim Tebow?
You don't know if you're going to be able to go get Tim Tebow. You know, you hope you can get him in their minds, but you don't know. So they needed backup. Plus, Tim Tebow becomes the third string project. You know, year one, Quinn is the backup. They need someone who can actually come in and play if Kyle Orton goes down. So there's a method to this madness. I don't know that Denver panicked. I think they decided they wanted to go up and get him, and they got him. You know, the question is, can he develop him into a starter and a good starting quarterback 3 years down the road? And that, you know, we just have to wait and see.
As far as Brady Quinn is concerned, I don't think this thing could have worked out worse
for him. Absolutely.
For anyone.
Oh, he wakes up Friday morning and says, well, here we go again.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean, now it's clear he's not going to get a chance.
Right.
Maybe in theory he could beat out Kyle Orton for the job this year, but you know, in their mind, they want Tebow to become the quarterback.
So his way would have to beat out Kyle Orton and then hope that, you know, Tebow doesn't develop.
He's playing basically, if he beats him out, everything he does from now until the time Tim Tebow becomes the starter, because he's going to be the starter.
He's auditioning for another team.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, it's been a rough start. A lot of it through circumstances beyond his control for Brady Quinn. Kevin, you're next on Mike and Mike in the Morning. What's your question for McShay?
Hi, Todd. I'd like to know what you thought of the Packers draft, and down the road in a year or two, are they looking for more linebacker help? Because I don't know if Green Bay is completely sold that A.J. Hawk can play in this defense.
Yeah, no, that's a good point about Hawk. He's not a perfect fit.
I've been surprised at that a little bit, I have to admit, with the Hawk situation. But they're
How about
overall?
The Packers draft?
I love their first-round pick. You know, they needed offensive tackle help. Brian Bulaga falls to
and
them
he fell, yeah.
And he's never going to be an elite left tackle starter, but you can plug him in right away. He's Kirk Ferentz does as good a job as anyone at the college ranks of developing offensive linemen. I think he can be a starter and a long-time starter at right tackle for the Packers. After that, I had some questions. I thought Mike Neal, I like Mike Neal out of Purdue, but in the second round I thought it was a little bit of a reach, and I don't know that he fits what they want to do. He's more of a three technique to me, so it'll be interesting to see how he fits in that 3-4 defensive scheme.
Jeff, you're next on Mike and Mike in the Morning. What's your question for McShay?
Thank you guys very much for having me on. Mr. McShay, I was curious what you thought on the New York Giants draft, whether they addressed any needs or kind of blew it.
kind of blew it.
They did definitely extend their run of having defensive linemen with unusual names.
Yes, they did.
Adding Pierre Paul to Kiwanuka and Umanyora.
And Pierre Paul has boom or bust quality. So it's going to take a couple of years, and this draft will be tied to how Pierre Paul develops. That's the bottom line. He has a chance to be a star. I mean, an absolute, you know, Javon Kurse type star, but he has to prove that he can do it over a long period, you know, a long period of time. He had 7 starts last year and played 1 year of big boy football after transferring from the JUCO ranks. So it'll be interesting. I think he's in a good situation as a rookie because he doesn't have to be a full-time starter, come in for 15 plays a game and rush the quarterback. But they didn't address the inside linebacker need till I think the 4th round, Phillip Dillard. And Dillard is probably going to be a career backup, in my opinion. So I didn't think they addressed a lot of needs, but I do think that Jason Pierre-Paul, people are criticizing it, but I thought that they got him right where he was supposed to go. And everyone says, well, he could be a bust. Well, he could be a boom as well. He could be a great player.
Kyle, you're on Mike and Mike in the Morning. What's your question for McShay?
Hey, McShay. How long until Klossman is the starter for Carolina?
That's a good question. Listen, you know, Mel and I went back and forth, and we had some fun with Clausen, and we had very different opinions. Of all the quarterbacks drafted, he's in the best situation.
Yeah, he is.
You know, in terms of being able to succeed. He doesn't have to play right away. They've got Matt Moore, but if he proves he's ready to play, then go ahead. He steps in as a starter.
And if he proves he can play, he's on a team where they have a good running game.
That's exactly
obviously
it.
Bradford, they have Steven Jackson. Yeah, I know that, but the rest of the team is really struggling. But Carolina has a good running game. You have Steve Smith to throw to on the outside. So, you know, he's surrounded by good players.
Depth at running back, Jeff Otah and Jordan Groh. I mean, you have good offensive line play as well. So I think that he has an opportunity. If he's as good as Mel Kiper thinks, as you think, and a lot of people think, then he should win the starting job, whether it's halfway through the season or preseason, whenever it is. He should step in, and he has an opportunity to have some success, a lot like guys like Mark Sanchez and Matt Ryan and Joe Flacco with a team that can play some defense and has a strong running game.
Mike and Mike McShay is here, also taking your questions on Twitter. You can follow us at twitter.com/Greeny and Golic. Here is some of the tweets. How will Dez Bryant fit into the Cowboy offense? What does that pick mean for Roy Williams' future in Dallas?
I love this pick. You know why? Because the Dallas roster is settled. They didn't make a lot of moves. It wasn't a spending spree where they went out and brought in a bunch of veterans. They have leadership finally. Tony Romo's the leader. There's no questions about it. There's no other real major character issues on that team. And I think they're finally in a place where they can bring in a Dez Bryant, who's not a bad guy. He needs some leadership. He needs some guidance.
Did the diva mentality make him fall? Was that what made him fall a little bit?
I think it was, you heard it over and over again, and I think it's the best way to put it, life skills. You know, showing up on time, being responsible, maturity, all of those things. And I just think he needs someone to take him under his shoulder and say, you know, follow me. I've said it a bunch of times. Chris Carter to Randy Moss. Maybe there's not anyone on that roster to do it, but at least Tony Romo and some of the established veterans. And if they do so, they have a weapon that they have not had in that offense. And you start looking at Miles Austin, all of the different weapons they have, Jason Witten at the tight end spot. This is a team that just got significantly better offensively if they can keep Dez Bryant on the right path.
More tweets. Hey, Niners draft, good or bad? What say you, McShay?
I like it. You know, I'm sure it wasn't the most exciting draft from a bunch of 49ers
linemen,
guys sitting around having a draft party. But if you're not going to get the quarterback, go out and get everything around the quarterback to protect him. They brought in two offensive linemen that can start right away. And I think that they make this the running games better. They averaged, I want to say it was just over 100 yards rushing per game. They gave up right around 40 sacks last year. Their offensive line was a big issue. And to me, they just made a huge improvement in that regard.
And then one pick after Clausen goes 48-49 is Taylor Mays, the safety, who is another one of those guys that looks good, has that look about him, but you're not sure about coverage skills. And he didn't have some nice things to say about Pete Carroll.
He
was upset with Pete Carroll, thought in the conversation he had with Carroll before the draft that if he was there, you know, if he was there, or he would be taken, you know, in the first round, not only wasn't he, but it was another safety who was taken in Earl Thomas, and he was a little upset with Pete for that one.
And he's dead wrong.
I agree with that completely.
Dead wrong.
Why?
Yeah. He's a solid player.
Yeah.
But go make some more plays.
Yeah.
Go make some interceptions. Stop going in and leading with your shoulder and wrap up and tackle.
Break up some balls, cover some, but that's what Earl Thomas does.
Be mad at yourself.
Yeah,
don't be mad at Pete Carroll. And Pete Carroll probably said, hey, you're in good shape. You know what? He is in good shape. He's a second-round draft pick going in the NFL with an opportunity to start. You know, you can't promise a player that you're going to take him. And guess what? If Pete Carroll thought he was that great, he would have taken him.
He would have taken him.
Instead, he took Earl Thomas. And, you know, it's motivation, and he should use it.
Yeah.
Taylor Mays should. But don't be mad at Pete Carroll. And certainly, if you're going to be mad at him, keep it to yourself. You know, tell your family about it.
I agree.
Don't tell the public about it.
He's a guy that looks for a knockout blow is what
everything,
he does at that position.
Everything Pete Carroll's done for Taylor Mays. I thought that was low.
I agree.
And Pete Carroll also, according to everyone, had a great draft.
Yeah,
right, I mean, everyone says they had a phenomenal weekend.
And the thing people don't realize, I think, John Schneider is the GM, new GM, and hasn't been there a whole lot as the GM. And all of a sudden, you got a new head coach. How do the philosophies mix? There's a lot of things that you have to work through. And they did a great job of putting their ego, checking it at the door, and just being able to find players that Pete Carroll wanted and great values throughout the draft. I thought they hit a home run.
There are several tweets that are complaining that we did not get a chance to mock McShay. There just seemed like so much legitimate football conversation to be had. We were concerned that sometimes the mocking would take away. So, McShay, perhaps you'll come back in the next couple of days and just let us make fun of you nonstop.
Yeah, just sit there and be a punching bag.
Just get beat up.
up.
That would be nice.
Sure, I'd love to do that.
We'll talk to your agent about that. McShay, you're the best. Thank you so much. Good sport, good spirits, and great inside information as we go through the draft.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
Buster Olney, who joins us every Monday at this time on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. By the way, Golic's recap of his experience on campus is coming up just a little more than 10 minutes from now.
Whatever.
You can see all the video at ESPNRadio.com. But let's start with this, Buster Olney, before we go through all the interesting stories from the weekend. There was a moment in a game between the Yankees and the Angels in which Mark Teixeira took out a catcher. And I found it interesting that there were a lot of players on the Angels who thought it was sort of a dirty play, and the Yankee broadcast team to some degree seemed to agree. What are your thoughts, Buster Olney, on the Teixeira play at the plate?
I don't think it was a dirty play because you see all this all the time where catchers in full gear set up next to home plate and they will feint as if the ball's not coming in, and then they will drop the shin guard and they will drop down with their face mask and they will just bury runners. And so you've seen in recent years sort of this trend where base runners say, you know what, I don't know what the catcher's going to do. I know if I slide, I might get a absolutely crushed by their shin guards, so I'm just going to hit them. And it seemed like Mark Teixeira didn't go out of his way to hit the catcher the other day, but he certainly wanted to put himself in position to score. But, of course, one of the first things I thought of when I saw this controversy was that Golic was going to make fun of baseball players.
No, listen, I have no problem. I agree with everything you just said. They have the equipment on. You know what? They're going to get run over because they get their shots in, too. I know sometimes they're not looking when they get hit, but they got the equipment on. And sometimes they use it to their advantage, and I don't blame them for that. So when they get run over every now and then, I'm okay with it. I don't have a problem. I'm with you on this one.
Well, if you don't want to get run over, don't block the plate.
There you go. I mean, and listen, they're taught to block the plate, and I have no problem with them blocking the plate. But you do that, you're going to get hit.
All right, let's go through some of the interesting on-field action of the weekend, looking at a couple of teams in the National League. Everyone was on the Braves bandwagon, and everyone was writing off the Padres before the season began. And obviously it is very, very early, but the Padres have been red hot, and the Braves suddenly look like a mess. Buster, what's going on?
Well, with the Padres, they're getting great pitching so far. They lead the majors in ERA, 2.73. They're getting offense all over the place. And before anybody decides they're going to write off the Padres, keep in mind that two of the teams we thought would be at least in contention this year, the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks, have absolutely deep pitching problems. We know the Dodgers, because of the divorce in the courts, didn't spend on pitching in the offseason. Over the weekend, Vicente Padilla, who was their opening day starter, was placed on the disabled list with forearm trouble. The Diamondbacks, of course, are not going to have Brandon Webb for the foreseeable future. So this division isn't going to be as tough as we thought, and maybe the Padres will take advantage of that. And even before this stretch, by the way, guys, GMs with other teams were saying they didn't think the Padres were going to trade Adrian Gonzalez this summer because his value is so high. And the Braves, I mean, it comes right down to it. One of the big questions that we had before the season about them was how many games would they get, how much production would they get out of Chipper Jones and out of Troy Gloss, and Chipper Jones is already hurt. And last night's game against the Mets, because of some hip problems he's having, he was having a difficult time getting to outside pitches. And Troy Gloss is hitting under 200. They're not playing very well. They have to get the ship right. And at some point, they're going to have to address this big offensive hole they have at first base.
So who in either league who's in an early hole right now has the best chance of digging themselves out?
I think the Braves, you know, eventually will, because they do have really good pitching. You know, Tim Hudson looks good early on. You know, to me, that's one team that I think you can expect come out of it. On the other hand, I'm not sure about the White Sox. They're having all kinds of issues offensively. And, you know, Jake Peavy and Gavin Floyd are supposed to be two members of what we thought was going to be really strong rotation, have gotten off to really bad starts.
Mike and Mike and Buster Olney, who, as I've said many times, deserves a producer's credit on the show because he is constantly sending me notes. And here's another one. Just run through some of the pitchers, Mike, and the starts they're off to. Names, you know. John Lester has an ERA over 6. Justin Verlander has an ERA of basically 7. Jake Peavy's is almost 8. Gavin Floyd's is over 8. What in the world is going on?
You know, Verlander, to me, out of that group, is the most interesting. We know Lester last year got off to a bad start, and then he bounced back. And you watch his games. His stuff is good. He'll come back. Verlander has always been one of these guys, great talent. And the question is, when will he put it together? You know, when will everything sort of click? And last year, it happened. He seemed to have focus for from game to game, from pitch to pitch. And in the games I've seen this year, that would be one of the big questions. That's one of the questions that scouts are having about him. You know, will he pull it all back together? And Petey, it was interesting because he had so much success in the National League. Now he goes from one of the great pitchers' parks in all of baseball in San Diego to one of the great hitters' parks in Chicago, and he's not doing that well.
Buster Olney every Monday with us. He'll be back a little later with the good, the bad, and the ugly, and more baseball later. John Kruk, his regular Monday visit at 10 after 9 Eastern, 10 after 8 Central Time. Thank you, Robert.
See you guys.